We'll be starting at 10 o'clock tomorrow. If you show up at 4, you will not have correctly anticipated the future, and you may suffer a loss. No, I won't. Now we need to talk about the ethics of competition a little bit as well. In the economy, you hear a lot about competition. And some people, including many churchmen, say competition is immoral. What we need is cooperation. Competition is immoral. What we need is cooperation. Well, any exchange, any interaction on an economic level is cooperation. If two people get together and they make a deal, they're cooperating. Economic society is cooperation. We talk about competition in several different senses, and I'll mention two. In games, we organize games. We organize teams, we organize leagues, and we have competition. It might be football, baseball, running, you name it. It's sort of an artificial situation, and we do it for the fun of it. Although the players, if they're professionals, are doing it not because it's fun necessarily, but because they get paid very well for doing it. They get paid very well, of course, because people are willing to pay enormous amounts of money to attend the games. Someone told me recently that seats on the floor at the Bulls game in Chicago a week or so ago, or maybe it was earlier this week, went for $15,000 apiece for a game that's going to last, 3 hours? People actually paid $15,000. They're probably the same people that then criticize the basketball players for all the money they're making, not realizing that they wouldn't be making that money if there wasn't the demand for their services. There are people willing to pay that much. People up in the nosebleed seats were paying $300 a piece for tickets, up so far that you get nosebleeds from the altitude, and you look at the floor with binoculars. They pay $300 to do that. And then they criticize the players for the salaries they're getting, not understanding the economics of it. Here we have the consumers shelling out these enormous amounts for basketball games and then criticizing the players for their salaries. The economy is cooperation. It's not organized as games are for the purpose of competition. Competition is a byproduct of each of us offering our products or services on the marketplace. It's a byproduct. I don't go into business or I don't offer my services in order to compete with someone. I offer them because I want to make a living. That's why I do it. I don't engage in business, or I don't learn a skill and become a tradesman, or I don't offer my secretarial services or whatever they might be, simply because I want to beat somebody at this game called economics. I want to earn a living. And the competition is simply a byproduct of each of us offering our services, each of us offering our products. Now, it's important to keep in mind that the competition that results happens between like people. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that laborers compete against laborers. Secretaries compete against secretaries. Computer programmers compete against computer programmers. Fast food restaurants compete against fast food restaurants. Employers compete against employers. Workers do not compete against employers. Workers do not compete against employers. Workers compete against workers. If there's a job opening advertised and the businessman gets 10 applicants, those applicants are the competitors. They're not competing against the employer. They're competing against each other for that job. You see this very clearly in the case of a strike. And GM is in the midst of a strike. There, the workers walk off their jobs, put up a picket line. Then what do? How do they compete against other workers? They do not allow anyone in to take the jobs. And this is an illegitimate form of competition. They are preventing other workers from entering the factories, workers who might be willing to work for less than $50 an hour, from entering the factory and taking the jobs. But see, it's aimed against other workers. Otherwise, a strike wouldn't work. Even the language of labor economics is colorful. A strike, that doesn't sound nonviolent if you strike. And in the history of the United States, labor disputes frequently have been very violent. And usually they're aimed at workers who would be willing to work. The use of violence. Threats are made, tires are punctured, shots are fired. Sometimes even people are killed in labor disputes. And nearly always, they're workers that are killed by other workers. And this is all immoral. It's all sinful. It ought to be outlawed. It's a violation of the Eighth Commandment, at least. Maybe the Sixth Commandment. And it ought to be punished. But the workers compete against workers. Now, employers compete against employers. If you're an employer and you go into the marketplace and advertise a position, you need to price that salary or offer a wage that is competitive with what other employers are offering. Otherwise, you're not going to get the work you want, get the help you want, the quality you want. Your competition is other employers. That's your competition. But again, the competition is a byproduct of each of us going into the market and offering our services or our products. We do not go into the market and say, well, I'm going to compete against him just to see who wins. We go into the market for a different purpose, and the competition is a result or a byproduct. As long as there's free entry, and that's what a labor union denies the workers when they throw up a picket line and prevent anyone from crossing it. And as long as there's free entry into a market, then there's no problem at that point. Yes, sir?
Is there also, because
unions you mean like a closed shop?
Yes.
Well, yes, some unions will insist on signing what's called a closed shop agreement with an employer. Now, if the employer agrees to that, then there's no problem. That's one of my problems with right-to-work laws. Because why should not an employer have the right to have one bargaining agent for all his employees? It might make things be more efficient for the employer rather than bargaining with each employee individually. Just say, you're going to be the sole bargaining agent for all my employees. And I don't see a problem with that. But if the union has achieved that position by the threat of force or the use of force, then there's a problem with it. Yes, sir. Go ahead. You mean morally? No, either one could be moral, depending on how they were arrived at. If the employer wants it that way, yes. It might be more efficient for the employer to do it that way. It's the employer's decision. He can say, sure, we'll just have one bargaining agent, and anybody who wants to work here will be bargained for. You will bargain for them, and if they don't go by that, I won't hire them. Nothing wrong with that arrangement, as long, again, as it's an arrangement freely arrived at. That is, when I say freely, apart from intimidation or coercion or threat, by the employer and the employees. Nothing wrong with it. But in many cases, unions have achieved closed or union shops and otherwise. Yes, they probably do. I heard of one out in New Mexico where we lived, and I never checked it out to see if it was accurate or not, but the rumor was that some fellow set up a gas station on one corner of the block because the gas station at the other corner on the same block had done him wrong in some fashion, and he thought he would get back at them by opening up his own gas station and driving them out of business. So there you might have a motivation there to compete against a nearby gas station and put them out of business. So I was speaking in very general terms. You find that occasionally, but it's not very often. The person who did it apparently had some other source of income and could afford to fool around like this. Neither gas station was particularly impressive. I think if you go back and to that part of New Mexico in 2 or 3 years, probably neither one will be there. No, not at all. Being better than him in this sense is offering a better product to your customer. You're not talking about being proudful or haughty or anything of that sort. Being better in this context means you're offering a better product than your competition. And how could you do that without being competitive? Well, no, if you're competing with him, if a customer comes to you and says, look, I can get a cabinet of this quality for 10% less from him, you're going to compete with him, and there's nothing wrong with it. Again, you're not competing with him in being proud or haughty or anything of that sort. You're competing in offering the customer a better deal. And that's how businessmen are better than other businessmen. The value they offer the customers is a better value. They get the same quality for less money or better quality for the same money. And it has nothing to do with your personal worth or his personal worth. He may be a scoundrel. You may be a scoundrel personally. But when we talk about, when we use the word better and apply it to a business, we're talking about the value they offer their customers. Okay. Very violent term. Very violent term. We have all sorts of violent terms. Well, I don't think it's realistic. You haven't cut anybody's throat, have you?
No, but the point is that not intentionally, but that's the idea that they're trying to discipline myself.
Oh, no, not at all. Now we're talking about something that we haven't talked about yet. This theory the gentleman's put forth, the economists call predatory pricing. again, it's all violent. See, we have the prey and the predator and cutthroat competition and strikes and all very violent language here. And what predatory pricing is usually described as is precisely how you've described it. One provider will cut the price on his product with the intention of driving someone else out of business so that after his competition is out of business, he can then raise his price and recoup any loss that he might have suffered in driving his competition out of business. This is usually the charge that's levied against Walmart, for example. Lots of small towns, the chambers of commerce of small towns have kept Walmart out because their argument is when Walmart comes in here, they'll cut prices, they'll drive us out of business, and once we're out of business, they'll raise their prices and recoup their losses. Well, Walmart doesn't do that to begin with, and not because perhaps they don't want to, but what would happen if they were to raise their prices? Your competitor drives you out of business. He cuts the prices below his cost, if that's possible. Let's say he does. He cuts the prices, drives you out of business, you're gone, and then he raises his prices. What happens now? Another competitor shows up. As soon as those prices go back up, somebody sees how profitable it is to build cabinets, and they open up their business. And it forces this fellow to drive his prices down again. In the meantime, he's out of business. And he'll have to go into some other work or reopen the business, whatever it might be. Again, one of the ideas we talked about, I guess it's in the first hour, was that the fact that some people go out of business, even a legitimate business, is fine. Because circumstances change. The demand for things change. The moral values have an impact on our personal behavior and on society in general. If everybody became honest tomorrow, lots of businesses would go out of business. And that's good. That is not bad. Well, you can do it maliciously. I'm not denying that. It can be done maliciously. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because in a basketball game, there can only be one winner. But that's not the case in the economy. Go ahead.
If you're a shrewd buyer of mechanical work, you encourage them to cut those so that they can drop their prices and you get a better deal all the way around. So if you're a better cabinet maker on the building, you're buying them. That's the way I look at it from the standpoint that neither one of us is not an enemy or anything. My work enemy is myself. My business where I'm not good at business, or the other thing is my moral stand before God, which is my heart attitude is saved. When someone just brings me off $10,000, I really need that money. There's immense pressure to want to raise that next deal because they just can't keep my dollars from the big loss and I can get it next time. And that's a reality. Honesty is a big business.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I had to say to myself, what's more important, God or me?
Yeah. It's not just business. It's in everyday life. People make mistakes. Stores make mistakes when they're checking us out. Are we going to call it to their attention? Or are we going to say, ha, they made a mistake. I'm going to walk out with that extra $5 or whatever. Serves them right. It's really my money anyway. We can rationalize it in many different ways. And that's where the idea of virtue and value comes in there, which is most important to us, as you said. But to get back to the idea of basketball here, in basketball there is one winner. But in the economy, there isn't. And I'd like to explain this in some detail. If you want to read a chapter of the Bible on the division of labor, read 1 Corinthians 12. I won't take the time to read it all here this evening. But I'd like you to think this through with me, if you would. We talked about Robinson Crusoe, engaging in what I called exchange with himself, autistic exchange. That is, he decides he's going to exchange 5 hours of nap time for 5 hours of work building a lean-to. He makes that choice. We have Robinson Crusoe all by himself engaging in autistic exchange. Obviously, he's not competing with anyone. He's not cooperating with anyone. Then in a small group where there's more than one person, we can have barter. That is direct exchange, direct interpersonal exchange. I'll give you a sheep if you give me a goat. Barter works okay on a small local level. And in the history of societies, many societies have engaged in barter. Then we have large groups. In fact, today, virtually the entire planet is engaged in indirect exchange, the use of money, the use of a medium of exchange, the use of money, indirect exchange. Now, at Robinson's level, there's no division of labor. He does everything himself. He does everything himself. Everything that gets done, he does. He's self-sufficient. Sometimes you hear people say, well, we ought to be self-sufficient. Well, if we were self-sufficient, most of us would be dead if we attempted to become self-sufficient. Think of your life. Think of what you have on. Think of what you've eaten today. Did you make any of your clothes? Did you grow any of your food? Perhaps one or two items. If you had to eat today or tomorrow, or wear tomorrow, what you yourself grew or what you yourself made, I suspect that most of us would be running around very thin and very naked. We're not self-sufficient. Robinson had to be self-sufficient. His wife, to use Hobbes's phrase, would have been poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Small group, you can have some cooperation. People can now begin to specialize. Now think of the small group. If you want to think of a small group, think of a family. Think of a pioneer family that heads out from the east and comes west. Why did the pioneer families want lots of children? Yeah, they knew that they would be able to work. They would contribute more than they cost, even though the children are going to be children for years. They wanted lots of hands so that they could have a small group and have a division of labor. Dad would do certain things, mom would do certain things, and the children would work on chores assigned to them. And in this way, the unit, the small group, would become much more prosperous than any one person working alone. This is the argument Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 12 about the church. This small group becomes prosperous because as they specialize, as they divide the labor, they become efficient and proficient at doing certain things. If Dad did everything in the pioneer family, if he worked in the field, came in and cooked the food and sewed the clothes and cleaned the house or whatever, it'd be a pretty messy place if Dad did everything. But because there's a division of labor in the family, then much more work can be done and both parties will live more comfortably. They will both benefit from it. You have right in the account of creation God's judgment that it's not good for Adam to be alone. He needs a helper. He needs a helper suitable for him. And the woman is created. Eve is created for that purpose, to be a helper. And when the children come along, as in the pioneer family, they are all going to be little helpers. They're going to have their chores assigned to them so mom or dad can do more important things, the things that require more skill, the things that require more judgment, more concentration, the things that they have an advantage in doing. So in this small group, where there's barter going on within the family, everybody is much more prosperous and more wealthy than if they had been out on their own. Out on their own, they're going to die. Out on our own, each of us would probably die. It's a rare person who is self-sufficient. Even many of the survivalists, you know, they come down into town and get their ammunition, or they buy their clothes, or they buy what food they need. They're not really self-sufficient. The benefits of cooperation, economic cooperation, are tremendous. The benefits, Paul says, of cooperation in the church are tremendous. Well, barter doesn't work well over large geographical areas. It works okay locally. Works fine inside a family. But the entire planet can be organized when a third item is introduced, a medium of exchange called money. Now you can have a tremendous division of labor. And you can see the benefits of small groups and versus entire planets or entire cities in this way. You go to a small town and you might find one or two restaurants. You come to a city the size of Portland and Vancouver and you'll find Mexican restaurants, you'll find Italian restaurants, you'll find French restaurants, you'll find Korean restaurants, Chinese restaurants. They've all specialized. They don't attempt to do everything themselves. They've come up with something that they're good at, hopefully. Sometimes they aren't, and customers find out to their regret that they're not very good at what they claim to be doing. But there you have specialization at the commercial level, at the retail level. You find this specialization all through the economy at every level, manufacturing, wholesaling, retailing. And people do it because, again, it's to their benefit to do so. By concentrating on what they do best, that is, what they're proficient at or what they're efficient at, it's in their interest. They gain more by concentrating, by specializing, than they would by trying to do everything themselves. So you have, in today's world, a very complex society, enormously complex. Trillions of decisions being made every day by people in the marketplace. And all of it is coordinated by the price system that we talked about yesterday. Now, let me explain the idea of advantage or comparative advantage and show how it affects the division of labor. And I'm going to give you an artificial example, and then I'll give you one that's more realistic. So we have three people. We'll have a very simplified society here. We'll have three people. Anne, Ben, and Calvin. That's the entire society here. And there's only two products in this society, and we'll call them widgets and blocks. Widgets and blocks. And let me write up here, widget and block. Okay, Anne can produce in one day 8 widgets or 4 blocks. Ben can produce in one day 3 widgets or 3 blocks. And Calvin down here in one day can produce 1 widget or 2 blocks. People have different abilities. People have different skills. They have different backgrounds. They have different educations. Their circumstances differ. These are the citizens of this simple economy. These are the products, and this is how much each one can produce. And notice the or in here. It's not a sum, it's an or. Now, let me ask you a question, and then I'll try to explain why the answer is as it is. Who is the most efficient producer of blocks? Well, we have a disagreement. Some people say the early answer is that Anne, others said Calvin. Can anybody give a reason why they think that either one, either Anne or Calvin, is the most efficient producer of blocks? Yes. Okay, he can produce twice as many blocks a day as he can widgets, and that's exactly right. That makes Calvin the most efficient producer of blocks. Let me explain that a different way. Think of opportunity cost. In order to produce two blocks, what does it cost Calvin in productivity? One widget. In order to produce four blocks, what does it cost Anne in productivity? Eight widgets. That is, each block here costs Anne two widgets. Each block costs Calvin a half a widget. Calvin is the most efficient producer of blocks. Yes, sir? Yes, good question.
I'm in charge of using blocks. I don't like
your answer at all. Well, let's define efficiency. What is efficiency? You've probably seen it on an air conditioner or a gas furnace or something. It says 90% efficient. What do they mean? They mean the energy output divided by the energy input. That's how they arrive at a 90% efficiency or whatever it might be. It's a ratio. The output divided by the input.
Okay, but the input is 8 hours of time. And the output is 4 or 2. Because 2 is
better than 4. This is his cost. We're not talking about time. This is his cost. His cost, his opportunity cost, is he can produce either one widget or two blocks. And if he produces blocks, all he pays for it is the one widget.
Oh, it's 8 hours.
Well, they're all paying 8 hours. Okay, let's go with this, because this is leading right into my next example. You're the economic czar of this society. You're the economic czar. And you want to maximize, as you said, the production of blocks. Okay? And let's just make a simple assumption here, that one widget is enough to keep everybody alive, all these three people, plus you, as the economic czar. So all you need is one widget, and then you want to maximize your production of blocks. And you've assigned Anne to producing blocks, and in fact, everybody, so long as you have one widget. So would you assign Calvin to produce the one widget then? No. No, he's the dictator. He's the dictator. We do not have two dictators here. Okay, very good. You're way ahead of me here. Okay, Calvin produces the one widget that's needed. So here we are. Now, at the end of the day, you would have your seven, did you say? You've got four blocks here and three blocks here, and you'd end up with seven blocks. That seems to be common sense. And this is, in fact, what economic dictators do. This is, in fact, why the Soviet Union collapsed. This is why socialist countries are always impoverished. Let's look at it as if Anne, or as if Calvin, were the most efficient producer of blocks. And let him produce his two blocks. So we have two from Calvin. We'll call it C2. And let Ben do the blocks. So we have three from Ben. And then we'll have Anne produce the one widget. And how many blocks does Anne produce?
Three and a half.
No overtime. We've got to keep this example simple. What do we end up here? We've got the one widget. But now we've got 8.5 blocks produced. In the marketplace, each person would do what he's most efficient at doing. And you would end up with one widget in both cases. But the economic dictator says, we're going to assign Calvin to produce that widget, so we end up with seven dots. In the marketplace, each one pursuing his self-interest does what he's most efficient at, and you end up with one widget and 8.5 blocks. The marketplace produces more than 20% more than the dictatorship. Now, this again is like that salary example I gave you at the beginning. It seems to be counterintuitive, counter common sense. But you have to keep in mind what efficiency is. It's a ratio. It's the value of the output divided by the value of the input. Calvin is the most efficient producer of blocks because he gives up only one widget to produce two blocks. And, on the other hand, has to give up two widgets to produce one block. So if the market arranges things, you're much more prosperous at the end. You have more than 20% more productivity in the market than you do in the economic dictatorship. Well, let's look at that. You might prefer the higher end, but the question is, would Ann work for you? Her economic advantage, her comparative advantage here, is not in producing blocks. Her comparative advantage is in producing widgets. She has, in fact, it's the opposite of Calvin's here. To produce one widget, Calvin has to give up two blocks. That's what his opportunity cost is. Every day he spends producing one widget, he's not producing two blocks. Every day Ann spends producing eight widgets, she's not producing four blocks. And she has a comparative advantage in producing widgets. That's her comparative advantage. You what? You mean you're looking for someone who would manufacture widgets for you? So you hire Ann. Let me give you a more realistic example. Maybe that will help. Let's say you're a businessman or a lawyer, depending on your preference. The law used to be a noble profession. Now let's assume that you're a businessman and your time is worth $200 an hour. That's why I choose lawyer, because this is about what lawyers charge. $200 an hour. Let's say you can also type very well and file very well. But since other businessmen or other lawyers have secretaries, you think, well, maybe you ought to get a secretary. So you advertise for a secretary. And the best applicant you get, you say, I'll pay a secretary $20 an hour. $20 an hour for typing and filing and answering the phone. Yes?
I didn't want to
fly. You have to go to Capitol Hill. You're advertising this job $20 an hour, and you have lots of applicants, and the best applicant types or can type 75 words a minute and do all your filing and is very good on the telephone. And unfortunately, you, who are a prodigy, can type 150 words a minute. And you can also answer the telephone much more efficiently than someone who doesn't know your business can. And you can keep your own files. Let's say you can do the filing twice as fast as the secretary, as the best applicant you have. Now, is it in your interest to hire someone who does the typing and the filing half as fast as you do? Why? Ah, very good. We're thinking in terms of opportunity cost. What you're giving up for every hour you spend typing and filing is $200. That's your cost of typing and filing. Because you're not doing your, you're not planning your business. If you're a lawyer, you're not meeting with a client or researching a paper or whatever. It costs you $200 an hour to do typing and filing. What does it cost you if you hire the best applicant who came? 40? No, it cost you $20 an hour. That was what the job offer was. Well, it's still $20 an hour. It's still $20 an hour. Well, okay, let's say you pay her 8 hours. Now, pay her $160 for the whole day to get the work done. Is it in your interest to hire her? Of course. You're losing $200 every hour you spend filing and typing. So even if you have to pay her for 8 hours to get the work done, you're ahead. It's to your advantage, it's in your interest to hire a secretary. Even though you can do everything twice as good or 8 times as good as your secretary, it's in your interest to hire her. People sometimes say capitalism is cold or free enterprise, doesn't take care of those with lesser abilities. But here you have an example. If you don't like the Ann and Ben and Calvin example, here you have an example of what actually happens in the market. I used this example in one of my economics classes, and I had a student come up to me afterwards. She was selling Mary Kay. She wasn't trying to sell me Mary Kay. But she said one of the things that the Mary Kay company tells their agents is, look, you can make, I don't know what the number was, $25 an hour. You really ought to think about hiring someone to clean your house. Because every hour you spend cleaning your house is costing you $25. And that's something that you can hire someone to do for $5 an hour. So it's to your advantage to hire someone of lesser ability, perhaps. Pay them to do the work, even if it takes twice as long, if you have a comparative advantage at selling Mary Kay. That person, the house cleaner, has a comparative advantage in house cleaning. And people don't understand this point. You're more efficient at selling Mary Kay, but the house cleaner is more efficient at house cleaning. Let me repeat that. The businessman is more efficient at conducting business, but the secretary is more efficient at filing and typing. Not more proficient. The businessman is more proficient. He can do it faster, maybe even better. But the secretary is more efficient because the secretary does not have this high value of input. The secretary cannot go out and make $200 an hour. So there's no high value input for the secretary. That's what makes her more efficient. What makes the businessman less efficient is the high value work as a businessman. And this goes back to a couple of examples I used the other night. Michael Jordan is very efficient as a basketball player and very inefficient as a farmer. What makes him inefficient as a farmer is the fact that he's so good at playing basketball. Every day he spends farming, he loses $300,000 that he could be earning playing basketball. So if he wanted to feed the hungry people of Chicago, he should play basketball. That's where his comparative advantage is. And he should give that money that he earns to people who have a comparative advantage in farming, because they can't play basketball like Michael Jordan. They don't have the cost that he does. His cost, every day he spends farming, is 300 grand. That's his cost. That's what he's giving up. That's the opportunity he is foregoing. The farmers don't have that opportunity. So he'd be better off playing basketball, taking the money and giving it to the farmer, having the farmer grow the food, and feeding the hungry people. Same thing for Jimmy Carter. His comparative advantage is not in carpentry. His comparative advantage is in giving lectures. I haven't checked the Speakers Bureau's fees lately, but he used to get $25,000 a lecture. Maybe he still does. Well, anybody that can make $25,000 a day, let's assume one lecture a day, is not using his resources wisely if he engages in carpentry. And if his goal is to help homeless people, that is, give the most homes, build the most homes for homeless people, then he ought to be lecturing. Turning the money over to carpenters who have a comparative advantage in carpentry and building a lot more homes. He could build a home a week if he lectures for 3 or 4 days. Build a home a week. He can't go out with a hammer and build a home in a week. Yes, sir?
How do you factor in what you said that the government said that they absolutely
can't do that? Well, that's one of his factors that would govern his subjective value. He absolutely hates to give lectures, and maybe he does. And then you have a question, well, what is my goal here? Is my goal here to build as many houses for the homeless as I want, or is my goal just to satisfy my own desire not to give lectures? And he has to take that into account. If that's his taste, that is, he finds it repugnant to give lectures, distasteful, something unpleasant, and it very well may be. But then you have the issue is not merely what the goal is. It's obviously not anymore just to build as many houses as possible. You have a different goal, and that may be the case. I don't know. Do you get $25,000? Any other comments or questions? See, this example surprises people. Because, again, it seems like the common sense thing to do is to have Calvin produce that widget and let everybody else produce blocks. And that's exactly the mistake of the economic dictators of the Soviet Union, the planners of the Soviet Union. And we'll talk more about socialism tomorrow morning, I hope. But this also explains the lack of prosperity in socialism. They make the wrong decision. In the market, each person would work at where his comparative advantage is, or tend to work where his comparative advantage is. Sometimes people get misplaced. Sometimes they don't understand, as Jimmy Carter apparently doesn't, what their comparative advantage is. And they get out of whack. But the second thing I want to emphasize is that in the marketplace, it's not a case of the winner taking all. In the example, the more realistic example I gave you, the businessman or the lawyer, he does everything better than his secretary. But he still hires a secretary because it's to his advantage to do so. Even though she works at a fraction of his speed, she benefits. He benefits from the transaction. The free market economy is not one in which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Because of the division of labor and because each person has a comparative advantage, they will find their own niche in the economy and benefit from the cooperation of everyone. If they're willing to work. You've got to be willing to work. Yes, sir? Well, only what I read in the papers. Yeah. Well, I don't think there should be such things as antitrust laws. The antitrust laws are a travesty. They're an attack on the rule of law. Several books have been written in the field of antitrust which make the argument in great detail. I'll only give you a silly example. from antitrust laws. And I don't know if Microsoft is being accused of this or whether they're being accused of something else. Under the antitrust laws, if you as a businessman price your product lower than the competition, you are apt or liable for the accusation that you are trying to undercut the market and corner it. This is the law against predatory pricing. If you price your product lower. Now, if you price your product higher than the competition, you're liable for the accusation that you are gouging the consumer. You're charging an unfair price and charging all the market will bear. You're gouging the consumer, exploiting the consumer. However, if you price your product the same as your competitors, you're liable for the accusation that you're engaged in collusion and price fixing. So under the current antitrust laws, whether you price your product above, below, or at the competition, you violated the law. And it's simply a matter of whether someone in Washington in the Justice Department wants to prosecute you. I'm afraid, I hate to tell you this, but we've probably all violated the law many times unwittingly. And if some bureaucrat decides he doesn't like you, he can find some grounds to come after you on the basis of this violation of the law. You have laws that make no sense. And the antitrust laws are a body of law that makes no sense. I think the Justice Department is doing to Gates what the government did to the trusts of the 19th century, the great trusts of the late 19th and early 20th century, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, the great trust buster. And it was those big businesses in the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century that put the United States on the economic map. It was those businessmen that made the America a world leader in economics, in production. And as we go into the 21st century, it's going to be people like Microsoft and Gates that is going to make America the world leader in computers in the 21st century. And if we destroy people like that for no good reason, we're doing nothing but cutting off our nose to spite our face. We're just harming ourselves. I don't know the details of it, Robert. I just don't see any purpose to it other than Janet Reno or somebody acting maliciously at the Justice Department. Yes.
So there's a two-part question. The first part is that the other people are going to have to
do it. They've expanded it to include Intel? Well, apparently their goal is to torpedo the entire U.S. Computer industry.
Probably they didn't answer both of those questions if they haven't given enough.
What was the other part of your question? Or is that it? Okay, okay. Any comments or questions about this? You see what economic efficiency is? You see how opportunity cost affects this? And if you keep in mind that we've traced cost back to choices, you can see how this all forms a logical system. Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm really interested in history, so how does this relate to the history of the spread? It seems like a lot of modern economic theories and the whole governmental intervention ties back to that kind of history. And that's just my opinion.
Well, no, you're quite right.
If my parents and grandparents, their attitude works, let the government regulate so that everybody can have a job, everybody can have a living wage, yada, 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 all that stuff. And it seems to tie back to that convention.
Yes.
Free market at some point is correct. That will happen with this.
No, not at all. I really, in 5 minutes, The intervention, the regulation started before then, but you're right, that is the watershed in American politics, because when the New Deal came to power, You find regulations all over the place. You see enormous growth. And the argument was, and the rationale was given by John Maynard Keynes, among others, the argument was that the market has failed, the market has crashed, it's collapsing, and we need government action to save it. And many people bought that argument. Now, there had been other panics, it was the word used prior to this, in American history, but they were short-lived. They'd last maybe a year, 18 months, and I won't get into the reason for those panics, but with the Great Depression, beginning with the stock market crash in October of 29, you see something new. What you see is the government intervening even before Roosevelt. Hoover is president, and you find the government in response to the crash and the growing unemployment, raising taxes. You find them imposing new taxes, raising tariffs. The tariff of 1932 was the largest increase in American history. This causes the collapse of the international market with that imposition of new tariffs. Domestically, they raise the income tax. They start spending money, that is, deficit spending. And this has further economic consequences. This goes on. What I'm saying is what might have corrected itself in a year or 18 months is now exacerbated by the response of government in raising spending, raising taxes, imposing tariffs, that sort of thing. Then in 1936, the Supreme Court finally hears arguments against many of the new regulatory agencies and declares them unconstitutional in 1936. And the immediate response to those decisions by the court is a burst of economic activity. You see somewhat of a recovery in 1936. And then what happens next is that Roosevelt threatens to pack the court. He says, I'm going to expand the number of justices on the court, and I'm going to appoint people who will back up my programs and declare them constitutional. And the court sees the handwriting on the wall, and says, oh, did we say they were unconstitutional? We meant they were constitutional. The court reverses itself in 1937 on these questions. And then you see we enter a new slump. The economic statistics show a new slump begins. And this continues right up until World War II. Roosevelt finally, after 10 years of unemployment, Roosevelt drafts 10 million men. And that's his solution to the unemployment problem. Begins the draft in 1940, a year and a half before Pearl Harbor. And then expands the war effort, imposes rationing. The Great Depression actually didn't end until after World War II. But in that period, Roosevelt was a very persuasive speaker. We had lots of them back then. You had Adolf Hitler, who was very persuasive in Germany. Franklin Roosevelt in America, Winston Churchill in England. Very, very good orators. And Roosevelt was very successful in persuading people that with his help, that is, with the help of the federal government, he was the first president who felt our pain. With his help, that we could all get through this horrible period in our history. And many people to this day that lived in those times believe that that's what happened. Yes, sir.
Is there any truth to the idea that the Federal Reserve System, fractional reserve bankers, has anything to do with the Fed?
Oh, yes, definitely. If I could, I'll take a minute and mention those. The panics, in fact, back in the 19th century were caused by manipulation of the money system by government or by its agents in the banks. But with the establishment of the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve Law was passed in 1913, and the system's established in 1914. And they really don't know what they have on their hands. It takes them a few years to figure out what exactly their powers are, and Congress is continually expanding their powers. During the 1920s, which you've probably heard referred to as the Roaring Twenties, the Federal Reserve was expanding the money supply. What it was an inflationary boom during the 1920s. You had lots of speculation fueled by the new money that the Federal Reserve was creating. Speculation in Florida real estate, speculation in the stock market, that sort of thing. And then the Federal Reserve decides to change its policy. And they change its policy, they change their policy in 1928. And the response is now a contraction, a rapid contraction of the supply of money. So you have, for several years, an expansion of the supply of money, and we haven't had time to get into monetary economics at all, but the expansion of money leads to lots of malinvestment, poor investments, in areas of the economy that things would not have been invested in hadn't that money been available. Then you have the Federal Reserve suddenly stopping its expansion, and you have a contraction in the supply of money, and this is what burst the bubble of the 1920s. And the speculation ends. The market crashes. The real estate market crashes. The stock market crashes. And this is a period of readjustment, as I say. They usually would straighten themselves out in a year, year and a half. In every case, in the 19th century, again, it was the government manipulation of the money supply that caused it. But this time, the government intervenes further. Rather than just cutting its expenditures and cutting taxes, it does the opposite. It engages in policies that are exactly what it should not do. If people are going through a recession, you don't raise their taxes. But that's what the government did. If they're going through a period like that, you want to be as less of a burden on them as possible so that the economy can readjust quickly. But they didn't. I'm sorry we haven't had time to talk about monetary economics, but if you understand these basic concepts, you'll be able to figure it out for yourselves. Yes, ma'am. Oh, sure. Somebody showed me Clarence Carson's book on economics. Read Clarence Carson's account of the Depression. The name we mentioned up here, Rothbard. Read his account of the Depression. There's another gentleman. Oh, what is his name? His book is called Economics and the Public Welfare. And I do not recall his name offhand. It's been some time since I read it. But read his account of the Depression. And you'll find them all helpful in understanding that period in our history. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
I think I'm just in a way well in my mind, like said,
I'm going
to look at the Broadway. And it's really as well as it's built in the middle of the year, so I'm intending to do it. I
think it's
five or two. So I just have to do my best. I don't want to have it, but it's really well. But I'm going to see
you in your
car. And I'm caught. Do you think a little bit about it and do that?
Well, if you come back tomorrow, I promise to speak for more than a little bit about it. You've hit on a central point, that is envy, resentment, sometimes called maliciousness. And it's a very powerful factor in economy. I'll recommend a book this evening. Get a book called Envy. That's the whole title of it. It's published 25 years ago. Again, the gentleman's name escapes me. He's a European name. It's a European name. I'm sure if you go to a university library, you'll find it, though. It's just called Envy, one word. And you'll find it very interesting. I'll talk more about it tomorrow a little bit. Any other? Yes, sir.
Well, after discussing the Great Depression, as it relates to climate change, because I wasn't really paying close attention in the last few years, but you're sitting on way more listening. You're hearing the same every day about the state of our economy, if it's good or it's bad. It's not because the state market collapsed, or it's not the collapse because things are radically changing the world economy, not the tax collapse, or,
I would not make that last statement. I would say that Paul's argument in 1 Corinthians 12, and we ought to understand that it applies to economic affairs as well, is that the entire group is hurt when one member is hurt. And Japan is the second largest economy in the world, and if Japan, well, it has officially entered a recession, if it gets worse in Japan, we're going to suffer. We're not going to be able to insulate ourselves from it, simply because that member of the world economy is hurting. Again, people find this anti-common sense, and perhaps it is. But we are better off when our competitors are better off. We are worse off when our competitors are worse off. If we're more prosperous, if he is prosperous, if our neighbor is prosperous, and he's more prosperous if we're prosperous. And when an economy the size of Japan runs into trouble, it will have serious effects on it. So I wouldn't write it off as saying, well, we can insulate ourselves from what's going on in the Pacific at all. It's, for one thing, it's not just Japan. People don't know much in this country about Indonesia. Indonesia is a large country. Indonesia has a population roughly the same as the United States. Many people don't realize that. And when Indonesia goes through economic difficulties, it's going to have an impact. They have a much smaller economy than we do, obviously. But when a nation of that size runs into difficulties, it will affect them.
Well, I understand those to the degree that I understand it. But I do these things. I was our source and I have a problem. But today,
that's why you're here, right?
Let me talk about how the economy that we have to operate is artificial. It's not based upon reality, not based upon real value. And it's artificially created, and so the lifestyle that we're living in right now and the plans that we make today based on what we see around us in our economy are deceptive, and they are not sustainable, and they are not realistic.
Whether they're sustainable or not is a real question. Because, I'll just mention one factor, the enormous debt, not just that the government has, but the consumers have, that businesses have. We have an enormous debt in this country. And that is one major reason for thinking that maybe this development isn't sustainable because of that size of that debt. Especially some of the consumer debt is very worse. Consumers just take those little plastic cards and go out and use them as long as they can. And then they'll file for bankruptcy. And that's very worrisome, is the size of the debt. And it's much bigger than the $5 or $6 trillion the government officially owns. So I can't talk about, I can't answer your question in detail, but there are real reasons to worry. Yes, sir.
Do you see much hope for our economy and the American solidarity?
Well, if certain things are done, then there obviously are solutions. I don't think we can get ourselves into a situation where there are no solutions. The question is, are the American people willing to accept the solutions? And I don't. I doubt if they are. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the first hour. Until the minds of people are changed, then it's futile, you're batting your head against a wall to attempt to get some things done. And the way their minds are changed at bottom is the preaching of the gospel.